This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is Miles Traphagen. He's the Borderlands Program Coordinator for the Wildlands Network. We've talked to Miles previously about the border wall, so we wanted to get an update. So that's what we'll be doing today. Welcome, Miles. It's good to be talking with you.
Thank you, Jay. I really appreciate you having me.
Okay. So the border is 1,950 miles long, and what was built since, how much wall did Trump get built while he was president?
Well, during the Trump administration, there was about 458 miles of border wall that were built.
Uh-huh.
And this makes for a total of about just shy of 800 miles of border wall that exists. But I think it requires a little bit further explanation, because I think the media often gets certain things wrong.
Uh-huh.
Of course, not your show, but so we're talking about border wall here. On the topics of border walls, you often hear the term fencing or border barriers.
Uh-huh.
But there's a real distinction between what's been built and the different types. So border wall is fundamentally different than, border barrier as
uh-huh.
a generic term. For example, there are vehicle barriers. And a lot of vehicle barriers are composed of surplus steel railroad lines that were put in Normandy barriers, like the jacks that you saw on Omaha Beach, to keep landing craft from landing on the beach. The purpose of these was to deter vehicle traffic from driving across the border. And in many areas, they really did serve to protect the environment, because places like Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge, they were getting a lot of drive-through traffic.
Uh-huh.
And so the resource was really being damaged. But in most cases, a lot of wildlife can pass through those vehicle barriers. It's not a problem for deer, mountain lion, most animals to be able to pass through.
Right.
But when they switched over to the bollard fencing, which in the lingo of the Department of Homeland Security was called replacement fencing. And this is what I was referring to, where the media has really mischaracterized this, especially kind of on the more left-wing side. They'll say, oh, the Trump administration only built 16 miles of new border walls.
Yeah.
And that's simply not true. It's because when they switched from these vehicle barriers to a 30-foot bollard wall, that is just fundamentally different.
Right.
There's simply no comparison. So that's why I think it's really important to understand the difference between vehicle barriers, border barrier fence, and border wall.
Oh, I see. Okay, so there's more impermeable wall now that stands, is that right?
There's a lot more, and the majority of that was built in Arizona, California, and New Mexico.
Oh.
Texas is kind of a different story due to a variety of reasons.
Well, because of the river.
And land laws.
Yeah.
The river has something to do with it, but there's some other elements of that as well that we
uh-huh.
can discuss.
And where they built in Texas is on the U.S. side of the river?
Yes, it's on the U.S. side. And like you mentioned, the Rio Grande River runs the entire border of Texas.
Right.
And it's a very sinewy river. The Rio Grande is an old river, so therefore it gets a lot of big meanders, especially when you're heading down towards the Delta in South Texas. And so therefore the border wall has been built in straight line segments across a lot of land in Texas, including private land and protected areas like national wildlife refuges.
Were those landowners compensated for where the wall was built?
Well, it's a condemnation action for eminent domain.
Yeah.
So it's the most forceful thing that the government can do to the land. And surprisingly, in a state like Texas, where they're all about their private land laws,
right.
their own state government really didn't care what the federal government came in and did to the local landowners. Mm-hmm. So now a lot of people actually have border wall behind them, and so they're between them and the river. Mm-hmm. So if you look at that, we're actually ceding land over to the other side by building these border walls. And this has happened in many places in Texas.
So how many miles now have been built along the Rio Grande?
Well, they're in the process of beginning border wall construction in a place called Starr County. And they have 17 miles planned, and then the state is building some. And that was, of course, just announced a few weeks ago.
Right.
And that's been a really point of contention, a lot of disappointment from a lot of people who did not expect this to happen.
Right. Yeah. I think the Biden administration claims that they were forced to do that because the money had been appropriated by Congress. That's a matter of controversy, I guess.
So, yes, it is.
So
what they didn't have to do is they did not have to apply the waiver of law to do this.
Uh-huh.
And so in 2005, there was a law passed called the Real ID Act, 2005. And in that, there's a provision that allows the Secretary of Homeland Security to waive virtually all laws for construction of border barriers. And this includes the Endangered Species Act, NEPA, Native Graves, American Protection Act, Bald Eagles, I mean, you name it. You know, all historical and cultural preservation laws are waived as well, so that they can expedite construction of these. You know, this is an extraordinary power given to an unelected, appointed political official. And it's amazing that Congress would actually cede that much power to the executive branch without any review. And so the Trump administration, of course, used the waiver authority more than any other administration, by like 30 times more. But the Biden administration did not have to do that. They said that they were required to spend the funds, but they were not required to waive the laws. And so that's where we're all kind of baffled. It's like, you know, why did you go down the road of authoritarianism when this is the most anti-American law that's ever existed?
Right. So there's additional landscape that was bulldozed in preparation for the wall during the Trump administration. What's the damage that was done as a result of that bulldozing? Has that been done all along the border, or just in certain sections?
Well, okay, it's in certain sections. And so at this point, I'd like to separate out Texas from New Mexico, Arizona, and California.
Right.
And the reason for this is because in the three western states, there is a thing called the Roosevelt easement. Mm-hmm. And in 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt set aside a 60-foot-wide strip along the U.S.-Mexico border, beginning at the Rio Grande, where in Texas, where Sunland Park, New Mexico, borders Texas and Mexico.
Right.
And it goes all the way to the Pacific Ocean at San Diego and Tijuana. And along this are the border monuments that were established in between 1890 and 1894 for the second Mexico boundary survey. Mm-hmm. And there's 269 of these boundary markers. They are like white obelisks, sometimes smaller silver, slightly different shape.
How far apart are they?
They're actually not at a fixed distance. They're at line of sight.
Oh,
and so
really?
The theory is, this is prior to barbed wire fencing, that you could stand at one, look to the left, look to the right, and know that you were on the line by seeing a border monument in the distance.
Right.
And they're still there. They're a really interesting feature of the landscape. So if you're ever down in this area, I would encourage people to go and seek out a border monument.
Yeah.
It's a great piece of history, and just as a side note, several ecologists, notably the late Dr. Raymond Turner of University of Arizona and Humphreys, they photographed the border monuments 100 years later to see what kind of change had occurred in the landscape, vegetation, grasslands, and so they served as like this good benchmark for baseline monitoring of vegetation in the land. So just a little side note there. But yeah, so the Roosevelt Reservation, that exists for the use of the federal government. Texas does not have that. So all border wall construction in Texas has to be either by private land sold to the government, or the little public land that exists along the border, or by condemnation, eminent domain. So that is why there's been less border wall construction in Texas than there has been in the three western states is because they didn't have that. So, you know, here in Arizona, we had tons of border wall built because they were allowed to have that strip. The unfortunate aspect of that is that there were many places where there were mountain ranges between where the Roosevelt Reservation crossed, but with private land surrounding it. And so instead of using existing roadways, and they blasted through mountains. And this is just a shame because they blasted through Coronado National Memorial, Montezuma Peak, where the beginning of the Arizona Trail is. This is a National Park Service protected land. And they did the same at Oregon Pipe National Monument and at numerous national wildlife refuges and wilderness areas, wilderness study areas. So the damage that was inflicted upon the land by taking this straight line of scrimmage approach to the border was simply, you know, unacceptable on many levels, from an ethical standard and also from a fiscal standard. So, you know, an average rate of, you know, $12 million a mile for border wall construction, up to upwards of $40 to $80 million by blasting through these mountains. Mm-hmm. It simply didn't make any sense when there was already a mountain that was, you know, impassable to begin with.
Right.
And even the Chinese knew this with the Great Wall, to utilize the landscape. So it's just really unfortunate that so much irreversible damage was done in order to build the border wall in mostly our protected federal lands in the West.
I'm wondering about local communities along the border, and I'm hearing that they are resisting the immigration problem. So how do these local communities now feel about where the border exists?
Well, I'll provide a general statement that one's feelings about the border become stronger the farther they get from it. And ask most people who live in border towns, border communities, they do not like the border wall. They do not like their city being militarized.
Right.
Toward the end of the border wall construction, right before the election cycle, this always happens, stunts like this, they put the razor wire all along that. And so they did this mostly in urban areas, such as San Diego, Tijuana, Calexico, El Paso, Nogales. And so now you've got this border wall in addition to all of this coiled razor wire, which is very lethal, this concertina wire. Not only is it dangerous to people and wildlife, but, you know, what does that do to a child growing up in a community where there's, you know, razor wire and a 30-foot steel wall and helicopters and bright lighting all over? It's basically they're living in a the shadow of a maximum security prison type of infrastructure.
When Biden was campaigning, and then after he was elected president, he said he'd stop the construction of the wall and then remove it. So it was stopped, but I don't believe any parts of it have been taken down. Is that right?
No, there's been no removal. And I never heard anything about Biden saying that he would remove the wall. But,
okay.
But he said not another foot.
Okay.
You know, read my lips. No, that was no new taxes. No, it was not another foot is what Biden said. And, you know, we always have to take, you know, the words of politicians with a grain of salt. The recent announcement in Texas of the border wall, that really blew things up, because before that, there were some small projects filling the gaps in the border wall.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certain locations, such as near Yuma, Arizona, where there were some gaps of 1,000 feet, 500 feet, you know, that large. They didn't build border wall across. And these became de facto ports of entry, where buses would pull up on the Mexico side, people would walk across the river, dry sections of it, and then the Border Patrol would have buses waiting for them, and they would process them for asylum. And these are people from all over the world, you know, Ethiopia, Ukraine, Venezuela, you name it. So what they did is they filled in those gaps. And in the briefings that I was on with DHS in the White House last year, they said that there was not going to be any extension of the border wall, meaning that if it ended in one valley at 20 miles of it built, they weren't going to keep on extending that, but that there would be some small areas that they would complete some of these gaps. So that's what they did in Yuma and a few other places along the border where there are some small, 10 and 20 foot wide gaps that were open. So if they would have just stuck with that, I could have said, okay, yeah, Biden has kept his word on this one. But the Starr County announcement was a sharp reversal from that.
All right. You told me earlier in the week that you might have some updated information as a result of a congressional hearing. So what happened this week?
Well, there was a hearing in the House Natural Resources Committee, and they, of course, the majority is pushing for to build more border wall and cherry-picking information in order to justify that. So there's some pushback on this, and we've provided information. A lot of people did in comments, basically saying that here's the elephant in the room. The question is there's 800 miles of border wall now, and there were nearly 500 miles less border wall when the Biden administration took over after Trump, but immigration rates have gone up. So here's the question you got to ask yourself. It's like, why keep on building border wall when the immigration rates continue to increase? I mean, it's a pretty strong data point.
Mm-hmm.
You've got apprehensions, you have physical wall on the ground, yet that's done nothing. Like, if you were just looking at this at a cause and effect equation, you would say, oh, the more border wall you build, the more migration you get. So, this is the unfortunate thing about what's going on in government now, is that they're not governing by the numbers nor the data. They're just basically governing on, what I call a tribal drumbeat in ideology. So, it's very clear that most people arriving, almost everybody now, are coming to ports of entry or these open gaps near a port of entry, turning themselves in. And I even asked a Border Patrol agent about this in a rural sector near Lordsburg, New Mexico. I asked him, I said, well, with all these, 500 people you're getting a day apprehending, how many are turning themselves in and how many are you apprehending in the mountains and the deserts? Mm-hmm. And before I even had the period on that sentence, he said, oh, 99.5% turn-ins. Everybody's seeking asylum. And I don't know why we can't just take that at its word and start improving our ports of entry and spending the resources where they can be actually effective versus a very destructive and expensive border wall that does not produce its intended results.
So let's talk about wildlife. How has it been affected by the portions of wall that have been built?
There's no doubt that it has impacted wildlife. In this part of the world, we have very little rainfall and very little surface water. And so a lot of desert wildlife change their movements over space and time in order to acquire resources such as food and water, other places to live safely. And those places where there might be water might be, 8 or 10 miles apart, but very seasonal. And so here, wildlife that live within a home range of these water sources, they're the ones that are really being impacted because, for generations, probably millennia of wildlife before them, they follow these routes. And, contrary to what a lot of dogma would lead one to believe on animal instinct, the majority of migration routes are learned from other animals,
right,
whether it's elephants on the Serengeti or it's, cranes migrating north and south. Mm-hmm. They need to be taught. So I think what could happen is that we could see regional extirpations of species, or at least lower numbers in places, because they're being impacted by the inability to move across the landscape at different times when they need to do this. And this coincides with this changing climate. September was the hottest month on the globe ever in all history of record keeping. 2020 was not far behind when they built the majority of the border wall. Mm-hmm. So here we have these unprecedented droughts coupled with high heat. And so at a time when animals need more space to move and survive, now they're getting less in the borderlands area. So that's really sad. And we're trying to study these impacts at various locations along the border in Arizona to see how wildlife were impacted.
Are there particular species that are most affected as opposed to others?
Some more than others. Of course, size is going to be a big determinant. You know, things like, you know, rabbits, skunks, you know, they can pass through the 4-inch gaps in the border wall.
Oh, really?
Fairly easily. Yeah, uh-huh. we've documented that. Mm-hmm. We've also seen even small javelina be able to get through, foxes. So it's not completely impermeable, and there's some places where the gaps are a little bit wider and the wildlife have figured out how to get through it. But once you get to the point of the size of a deer, the size of a mountain lion, size of a jaguar or Mexican right. wolf, yeah, there's going to be no permeability for those. And we've actually got a really strong data point for that. And this is two Mexican wolves, just about 5 years apart from each other. Mm-hmm. In 2017, a Mexican gray wolf that was part of the binational recovery program that was released in Chihuahua, a place called Campo Verde, it made a 600-mile journey in 32 days where it came up through the grasslands of Chihuahua up to Las Cruces, New Mexico, mm-hmm. spent about 2 or 3 days there, went down the Rio Grande River all through, you know, suburban and farming communities, mm-hmm. Spent a few days on a mountain called Mount Cristo El Rey, which is near the El Paso area, mm-hmm. and then it returns back to Campo Verde. And so we have the GPS satellite collar points for that, mm-hmm. 4 points a day, mm-hmm. and that was prior to the border wall being built. It was just a vehicle barrier in that location. So let's fast forward to November of 2021, and another Mexican gray wolf with a collar came out of the Gila Wilderness, part of the American part of the binational recovery program, mm-hmm. made its way down to the Rio Grande River. Within, I counted one point that was 100 meters away from the one 4 years earlier that had, you know, for some reason they had converged on the same path and trail. Mm-hmm. So it's remarkable. But that animal went down to the border and it paced along there for 2 or 3 days in the same location that the other wolf did. And it was unable to pass through the border because a border barrier had been built, a big 30-foot mm-hmm. border wall yeah. with only 4-inch gaps.
Yeah.
And then he returned back to the Gila Wilderness. He was actually shot and lost one of his legs, but he's still alive, mm-hmm. and now he's going to spend the rest of his days in one of the breeding facilities here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. But that's a pretty strong data point. When you've got satellite collar information that actually show the impedance layer is what we call it in, you know, GIS and ecological modeling, that it encountered this impermeable barrier mm-hmm. and it stopped it. And you can see it. It went back and forth east-west along the border for, you know, 2 days. Mm. So, you know, I think that even though that's only, you know, two wolves, it's one of the very stronger data points we have versus mm-hmm. our camera trap studies where we're relying upon, you know, density estimates, inference, and number of occurrences at a camera. And, you know, if we're really going to get at the root of this problem, I think it's going to require collaring a lot of animals to see their movement. And especially larger, more rare species like the jaguar, which there's been 7 documented in the U.S. since 1996. One just came up, a new one just a couple months ago here, possibly 8 if it's a distinct individual. You know, you're looking at a period of 25 years of 8 animals. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get lucky enough to get one on a camera trap and also repeatedly on different camera traps where you can start to, you know, build a detection rates. No, the only way we're going to get through that problem is by having satellite tracking collars, which are, you know, that's pretty routine in today's wildlife research world. So if we could get collars on jaguars, that would help us immensely to understand their movements and potentially see if they are being impacted by the border wall. Because at this point, we simply don't know, you know, we haven't seen that signal, the actual data point showing that a jaguar came up to the border, encountered a border wall, and then turned around.
Have you discovered that any have changed their movement routes and have gone around the wall at either end?
No, we have not. We've simply have not had enough time to do that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then we weren't able to collect baseline data because here they announce these border walls and then a couple months later they start building them. With any other sort of federal project, whether it's a highway or a bridge or a rail line or a mine, you would have to do the proper NEPA studies to see, okay, what's going to be impacted? How do we mitigate for those? Is there option A, B, C, D that we could use in order to minimize the impacts upon wildlife and the environment? And so, of course, none of that was done because of the waiver authority under the Real ID Act of 2005. So we're kind of operating in a less than ideal scientific research framework, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So who's doing the work? Who's doing the scientific research? Do you have colleagues with Wildlands Network, or are there other organizations you're partnering with to do this research?
Yes, Wildlands Network partnered with Sky Island Alliance, the one out of Tucson.
Uh-huh.
And we began a research project at San Bernardino National Wildlife Refuge last June.
Uh-huh.
And so now we have over a year of data, and we've got a few results from that. And we'll be submitting some results for publication here shortly. But we have an array of cameras along the border so that we can determine species composition, species density, if there's a difference between distance from the border wall versus, you know, if it's 1 kilometer from the border, 50 meters away, 200, et cetera. In addition to that, we have video cameras that are on some small openings in the wall because they put in some 8x11-inch wildlife passages, which when they announced that several years ago, everybody thought it was ridiculous. But we actually are seeing animals taking advantage of these very small holes.
Oh,
of course, not deer and wolves and things like that. But at least we are seeing that some amount of permeability does exist in the border wall. And we're just on our first year of the study. Basically reverse engineering it because, you know, from a research experimental design perspective, the treatment was done, meaning like you're going to study a prescribed burn after they already did the fire. You usually kind of take some baseline measurements beforehand, but we didn't have the luxury to be able to do that.
Right,
so
right.
We're just doing our best to try to reverse engineer this process.
Miles, I hate to tell you, but we are out of time, but I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Maybe we can do it again. So I have a lot more questions to ask. So thank you very much.
Anytime.
Okay, our guest today has been Miles Traphagen, the Borderlands Program Coordinator for Wildlands Network. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.